Coming up on Weekend America.
Home is more than a house.
Home for me was not a physical place. It was what my dad smelled like when he walked in at the end of the day. Dust, grit, tank oil.
Stories of home this Thanksgiving weekend. I'm John Moe. For Vietnam-bound soldiers, home was far away.
When I saw his name, Pigpen, on one of the canvases, it kind of made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It was Larry Pigpen Jones. I was with him up till the time he got killed.
Now the bunks they slept on are touring the United States. And John wanted to get away from home, so he started running and didn't stop.
The Kangamangas Highway from Conway to Lincoln, it's actually 26 miles uphill.
Is this a good memory for you?
Oh, it's awesome.
A 124-mile jog across New Hampshire. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. I've been thinking about the idea of home a lot lately for a couple reasons. For me, this was the first Thanksgiving in my new hometown of St. Paul. I think it takes a big holiday or two to make a new city feel like something other than just a place that you're visiting for a really long time. I've also been thinking of home because that's what our show's about this weekend. We're exploring the idea of home and all that it can mean, whether it's a house or a town or a home state that you run all the way across, like one guy this hour. Maybe it's just a state of mind. Finish this sentence for me. Nothing says home like...
Nothing says home like food. That's all I've been thinking about to try to prepare for a weekend with my son coming home.
Apple pie. Seriously, every time I come home, my mom makes an apple pie. I'm real American that way.
Coming home to my kitty cat. That's home for me, wherever Bruce is.
Nothing says home like my new puppy.
Nothing says home like a really messy house. You get home, you know you've got to clean, you see all the things you haven't done, kind of reflects your life back to you.
I wonder if the new puppy guy and the messy house lady are related. Maybe they live in the same house. Those voices came from San Francisco, Cincinnati, and Washington, D.C. Pico Iyer might feel at home in any of those cities. He's been called the nowhere man and a privileged homeless person. He's a travel writer and author, and he lives all over the place. Born in Britain to Indian parents, he eventually wound up in America, and he now divides his time between Japan and California, and much of his life is spent 6 miles up in the air on the way somewhere else. So what is home to Pico Iyer? Pico Iyer, welcome to Weekend America.
Wonderful to be here.
Just giving a rundown on your past is like reading an atlas.
I know. I mean, home is really a work in progress. I feel that when I was young, home was an essay that would take me 20 pages to complete. And now it's probably a haiku. So if you were to ask me where's my home, it would really depend on what day it is and what time of day.
Well, how about today?
Today it feels very much like Japan because I'm sitting here in the middle of the autumn with the sunlight streaming through the windows. And I think if you've moved around a lot, as I have, it's really important to have one still point in your life, one steady base. So for more than 20 years now, I've come back to Japan for about 6 months of every year. And when I'm in Japan, I don't even have a car or a bicycle or anything really. And so I'm very, very fixed. And then that's what allows me to travel around the rest of the time.
Why Japan?
I think just affinity. And I suppose I always feel that when we're choosing a home or a job or a partner, what we're really looking for is that special mix of strangeness and familiarity. Strangeness enough to keep you interested and not to feel that you know everything, but familiar enough to make you feel rooted and protected in some ways.
Does the fact that Japan is exotic and feels other to you, even after all these years, does that make it a little bit easier when you spend the other half of the year traveling because there is no place that is completely of you where you spend a lot of time?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, I think probably it does. And I think also the fact that my life in Japan is so quiet and so changeless, that is something I can carry with me wherever I go, so that in the middle of the flux of being in Times Square or moving from place to place the rest of the time, I always have that still place I can return to in my mind. And I should say that the other thing I've done for almost 20 years, because I do move around a lot, is to retreat four times a year into a monastery, and that's another still place. And I feel that wherever I am in the world, even if I'm bouncing from airport to airport, so long as I have the image and the atmosphere of that monastery and of Japan in my head, that will steady me through whatever comes. And I've got to say that my official home, where I pay my taxes, is in California, and I've been based there 40 years now, and it actually seems very alien and different to me, too. So I suppose I always feel that if I'm in California, a part of me is completely accepted, because California, like America, is a land of immigrants, but a part of me will never be fully Californian. Whereas when I'm in Japan, I have the clarity of knowing I'm 100% outsider. And I suppose what I'm really saying is I'm the odd kind of person who's always been at home feeling a foreigner. Since the day I was born, I felt a little outside whatever society I was in, and I felt comfortable with that outsideness. It's almost, I suppose, what I seek. And I know that's not, of course, what everybody knows, but that's my experience.
You've also had the experience of losing your home to the California wildfires. How did that experience affect your thoughts about home?
I think it made suddenly literal what had always been almost a metaphor. In other words, I'd always referred to myself kind of blithely as being homeless or not having a home in the soil, but having a home inside myself. And then one day, as you say, I was sitting in my home in the hills of California, and I looked outside, and suddenly there were 70-foot flames arcing over the living room. And by the end of that evening, the house was reduced to ash, and everything I had in the world was reduced to ash. And yet, the next day, clearly I was living with the inconvenience of not having any possessions and not having literally a roof over my head. I just slept on a friend's floor. But at the same time, I didn't feel that terrible rending that some people might feel, because I'd always had the sense of home as being something fluid and mobile and something that was as much with me inside me after my house burnt down as before. So I suppose it just underlined this intuition I'd had all along.
Pico Iyer, travel writer and author, thanks for inviting us into your home.
Delighted to talk to you.
Pico Iyer is the author of The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. He joined me from Nara, Japan. There's a transcript of a much longer version of our conversation. We actually ended up talking for quite a while, and you can read it online. Read Pico's thoughts on how technology shapes our idea of home and interconnectedness, what Thanksgiving means to him, and what it was like when his new California home almost burned down as well. That's all at weekendamerica.org. We asked you for your stories of home on some recent shows, and you sent dozens of great stories, thoughtful essays about the meaning of home, and you entertained us with some really harrowing housing adventures in some cases. Here are a few of our favorites.
My name's Michelle, and I live in Oregon. My dad took a job in Saudi Arabia. I lived there with my family for 3 years, and then I went back to the States to go to private school, and I was really lonesome, and I missed my family, and I missed my friends, and so I was down. And then I would have to travel on an airplane for 14 hours, and it was just exhausting. And the customs process, as you can imagine, getting into the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was very strict, and so that was grueling. And then I would come out, the door would slide open, and it'd just be crowds of people jammed in together. And, you know, because there's big planes coming in and everybody's waiting for their family. And I would stand there, just scan and look. And always would be able to find that Boston Red Sox cap, because my dad always wore a Boston Red Sox cap. The old fashioned blue cap with a big red B on it. And, there was just a sense of relief and home.
I'm Annie Smith, and I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. Oh, that first day that I bought my house, it was 1998, I think, and the house was all of 998 square feet. And I was so excited on this moving day. I was in every room at once. I couldn't decide what to unpack first. And I kept bumping into this little heater that was in the hallway. So I decided, well, you know, I'm pretty buff. I've been going to the gym a lot, and I'm gonna try and just pull this thing off the wall and put it in the corner and get it out of my way. So, and I get down and I'm in the squatting position, and I grab the heater, and I rip it from the wall, and all of a sudden, I hear this hissing sound, this tss, coming from the wall. It was a gas heater, and I see right away, I've just ripped the gas line open. And so I'm panicked, so I think, all right, you know, I have a phone, I'm going to call 911. So didn't take them long, and I hear this sirens roaring down my little quiet neighborhood street, and they stop in front of my house in this 100-foot ladder fire truck, and, you know, way oversized for the job, really. And the guys get off the truck, and they're in their full gas firefighting uniforms, and they jump off the truck, and they leave the siren running, which I wish, you know, I can't understand why the siren's still running. And they run down my little sidewalk, and I open the door, and you know, I tell him where the problem is, and he reaches down and looks at it and stands back up, and they all kind of take a deep breath, and he looks at me, and he's like, lady, lady, lady. You know, and he puts a kind hand on my shoulder and says, let's go outside and walk around the side of the house. I'm going to show you something really important here. And so we all go outside and dig through the bushes, and he finds the shows me that where the gas line is and the knob to it, and how I can simply turn the knob off and solve the problem right there. And it was a memorable experience. And once they pulled the fan off and drove off, I finally got to enjoy my new home again, but never did forget that day.
My name is Annabeth Pettit, and I currently live in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. My dad was an Army officer for 30 years, so you'd call me an Army brat. All of our houses were the same. It didn't matter what undesirable little slice of land we lived in. They looked the same. They were white, cinder block walls. The windows were painted by the lowest bidder every time somebody moved, so they never really worked properly. And most of the places I lived in, at two or four or six houses all crammed together with shared walls, and you could hear the phone ring next door. Home for me was not the physical place. It was the uniform. It was what my dad smelled like when he walked in at the end of the day. Dust, grit, tank oil, just there's some kind of mustiness to those uniforms. They were battle dress uniforms, and they have this really unique musty smell, and I just knew when he was home, you'd hear clump, 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 and smell the dust and the tank oil, and I knew Dad was home.
You just heard from Weekend America listeners Annabeth Pettit of Eden Prairie, Minnesota, Annie Smith of St. Louis, Missouri, and Michelle from Oregon. We have lots more stories of home on our website. There's a wonderful story from Cynthia, who remembers from 1955 being in a car with a turkey, dead turkey, cooked turkey, for three or more hours. That smell stays with her more than 50 years later. All sorts of different stories. In fact, you know what? Go on that website. Go to the website for this story and let us know what home means to you. It's so much more than a house. It can mean a lot of different things. We still have more holidays coming up. We got Christmas coming up. We got all sorts of things coming up. Let's explore this idea a little bit at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
There's crime, poverty, drug dealers all over the place. But what if it's the only home you've ever known? And then you move. Next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, as you gather with family at home or as you don't, we're hearing stories about home and all the things that that word can mean. Michael Whitehead of Chicago has been thinking about it a lot this year. Michael was a longtime resident of the Ida B. Wells Projects on the south side of Chicago. The six-story building went up in 1941 and was soon engulfed in a larger complex of high-rise public housing structures that became notorious for violence and drug dealing. The buildings are all empty now, and they will soon be torn down, part of the city's efforts to integrate public housing residents back into the fabric of the city. But for residents like Michael, that transition hasn't been easy. Stephen Smith of American Radio Works has our story.
Until a few months ago, the only home Michael Whitehead ever knew was in the Ida B. Wells housing project on the south side of Chicago. And this is what you would hear around his building.
USDA, USDA.
These guys are calling out brand names for crack or heroin. USDA, Red Bull, and believe it or not, Obama.
Obama blows, working. Obama blows, working.
Just like the other day, I come out my apartment, guy laying on the floor, hollering, screaming, still got the needle in his arm. Well, you get sick of seeing it, but what can you do?
What Michael Whitehead must do is move. Chicago is in the middle of a massive mission to empty the old housing projects like the one where Michael lives. It's part of a nationwide trend. But moving can be a problem for people who've never lived outside the projects, never had to pay rent or sign up for utilities.
Mr. Whitehead, this is Sandy Roberts. I work with Melanie Tony. And I'm going to take you to see your apartment today. Are you ready? Okay, well, will you come out to the curb? I'm driving a gray, silver-looking Scion. That's the little box car.
Sandy Roberts is part of an army of social workers deployed by the government to move Chicago public housing residents to the private sector. They've been given 3 months to get everybody out of Ida B. Wells, including Michael Whitehead.
Your voucher should say how much rent that you are going to be paying, according to your income. Did you look at your voucher sheet?
Yep, it was so many papers, I didn't know which was which.
Okay.
This is it.
No, that's not it.
It's not it. How much your voucher?
The social workers told Michael he had several options for new places to live. He decided to take what's called a Section 8 voucher. He'll find a private apartment, the government will pay his new landlord most of his rent, and Michael will be responsible for the utilities. He's never looked for an apartment before. That's why he's getting help.
But your fear is what, again?
That like you... I say, I don't want to go somewhere and then have problems. Like I say, with the light bill or whatever.
Well, one of the good things is you can control your lights. So if you feel that you're using too much, you can.
But you know, I wouldn't know that until the first bill comes.
But I don't think you'll have much to worry about. The electric bill comes.
Michael has never paid a light bill. Michael moved into the projects when he was 9. Now he's 57.
Like I say, I am. Worked all my life and stuff. It's not that I'm scared of work or don't want to work it. It's just not happening for me yet.
Michael's been unemployed for several years since a construction accident left him blind in one eye. He lives on about $300 a month from the government. He pays no rent at Wells. Sandy shows him an apartment and then drives him back to Wells, past boarded-up buildings to the one where he lives.
This is 540. This one is the building they closed.
We emptied this one already.
And this one right here next to a 527.
We emptied that.
That was a drug-infested building, both of these. The one right here next to a 559, drug-infested.
It's a slow day, huh?
Yeah.
Despite the problems, there are things Michael will miss about living at Wells. We gave Michael a camera and a tape recorder while he was waiting to move, and he took the gear all over his neighborhood.
So I'm headed to 39th and Cottage over to Mandrake Park. Well, I hang out with the old-timers, sit and play cards, tell jokes, tell a few lies.
Michael has his regular card table in the park and a guy he plays chess with almost every day. The friends reminisce about old times, when kids still played in the playground. Now there are no kids, just a lot of needles lying around.
That's the worst thing you can do with the needle. You can be through with them. Dispose of them. The correct way. You got kids out here. You know how bad they is. Now they ain't grow up like how we did. I've been around people. My uncle used to shoot up. He shot up and had an overdose.
Yeah.
But he was respectful, you know, back in the day. He was respectful with his He would pick his needle up. He would break the thing off, too.
Not only that, smoking crack, you shouldn't be doing that in front of kids. Mm-hmm. Doing blow, you shouldn't do none of that.
Respectful, man.
Michael and his friends say a long time ago, people were proud to live at Chicago's Ida B. Wells projects. Michael remembers when neighbors mowed the lawn here and kept up their apartments. But drugs took hold in the late 70s and the early 80s, just as blue-collar jobs were disappearing. Drug dealers became the local breadwinners. Kids sold drugs to their parents. The gangsters made the rules. But they won't be working out of Wells anymore. At summer's end, all the buildings were boarded up, including Michael's, and all the residents were gone.
So I've been here a month and 2 days.
Michael found an apartment 30 blocks south of Wells. He stands at the door of his building. He's smiling. It's a three-story brownstone with a security entrance and a fenced backyard.
So far, it's been great. I like the building because it's clean all the time. It's no people standing in front. And, you know, it's a big difference from where I came from.
One flight up, Michael's kitchen and bathroom have nice modern fixtures. The Chicago Housing Authority gave him $200 to help with the move. He spent it on a microwave, a set of dishes, and some minutes for his cell phone. He'll pay $20 a month for rent, which leaves him $80 plus food stamps to live on each month.
Only thing I can see is hurting me. It all depends on what this light bill going to be like. Other than that, yeah, I can make it.
That was back in August. We spoke with Michael again this month, and he has good news. He's on an installment plan to help with his electricity bill, and he likes the new place. But it's still not quite home. Home for Michael Whitehead is Chicago's 39th Street and Cottage Grove, where he still goes as often as he can to see his friends. I'm Stephen Smith for Weekend America.
Stephen Smith heads up American Radio Works, the documentary unit of American Public Media. This story is part of their project, The Real Face of Poverty, which receives support from the Northwest Area Foundation. And we have a slideshow of those pictures that Michael Whitehead took around his old neighborhood. We have the Ida B. Wells housing projects. We even have some pictures that Michael didn't take, historical photos of how those projects used to be, to accompany pictures that Michael took of how they look today. Also pictures of parks, his friends, some games of dominoes, and links to the history of the Chicago housing projects. It's all at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
He's got a rented truck and a load of military bunks, and he's on a mission to reconnect veterans with their past. Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Can't imagine Barack Obama's having a very restful Thanksgiving weekend at home. He told Barbara Walters he was having 60 people over to his house. Then he's got to get ready for his new job. He's moving. Busy time. Obama and America are both in transition. Announcements of appointments and plans are coming up a lot. Talk about what's important, what's a priority. We're having that discussion, too, in our ongoing series, Conversations with America. This week, we join author Mustafa Bayoumi as he walks through his Arab-American neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York.
In Brooklyn, there are several different neighborhoods that have relatively large concentrations of Arab-Americans and of Muslim-Americans. Probably the most important one is Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And then the older neighborhood would be the downtown Brooklyn area around Atlantic Avenue.
Assalamu alaikum.
They sell a lot of cassette tapes and pamphlets. You have Chinese food that's halal.
It's very busy. You have halal fried chicken liver for $5.95. Halal fried chicken gizzards for $5.95. What's good?
Everything here is good. Actually, yeah, it's nice halal Chinese food. My favorite, I always go for shrimp with vegetable and white rice with $1 extra shrimp. Yeah, everything here is halal. Yeah. Alhamdulillah.
Halal is a religious way of slaughtering meat so that it's religiously sanctified. It's similar to kosher. Halal restaurants also would not serve pork or any pork byproducts, and they also wouldn't serve alcohol. One of the interesting things about the Muslim community in Brooklyn is its multinational character. Some of the Chinese halal restaurants are run by Chinese Muslims. You have Muslims really coming from all different parts of the world and coming here and creating an American Islam. One of the elements that's very exciting about it is that it's less and less ethnically identified. In the older generation, you'd have the Turkish mosque, you'd have the Albanian mosque, you'd have the Arab mosque. But if you talk to the young people, they're really interested in the fact that they can connect with people from all over the world as Muslims and as Americans.
Let's go to Rashid.
Okay.
The war on terror has really alienated a lot of American Muslims who feel that they're really at the center of an American law enforcement practice that makes them immediate objects of suspicion. So immediately, they're made to feel not at home. And you can find this along the street life in Brooklyn.
9/11 pushed us back into the Stone Age.
Exactly.
Even worse.
Yeah.
Every bad stereotype of an Arab came to light.
That's right.
And then some we never heard of.
Absolutely.
If I could take Obama with me anywhere in Brooklyn, I would have to take him to some of the restaurants. Maybe this Yemeni restaurant where they serve the most delicious fool for breakfast. Fool is fava beans that have been mashed up Yemeni style, and it's absolutely delicious. We could sit there, and I think that we could talk about the war on terror policies, how they've really distorted what real life is like for Muslims, both in the United States and across the world. MDC is the Metropolitan Detention Center in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. And MDC is a prison. Following the terrorist attacks, several thousand people were swept up by the government and then placed in detention. Many of them found their way into MDC. And in the male wing, there were several who, as reported later on, were horrifically abused. In my book, I talk about Rasha and her family, and they were actually detained in MDC. Rasha was 19 when she was arrested. They had no idea when they were going to get out. And of all the people that I've talked to, I think Rasha is the most excited for an Obama presidency. It's not surprising to me, because if you haven't understood what it means to have your civil rights trampled upon, it's an abstract idea. But if you do know what it means, then it's an extraordinarily important thing that you can never really let go of in your life. And so it's really, I think, it's extremely important to consider those kinds of reactions to Obama. And that, in fact, places a strong burden on Obama. And I think we have to keep pushing that a civil rights agenda be also at the core of his presidency.
Mustafa Bayoumi is an associate professor of English at Brooklyn College and author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This being a holiday weekend, we wanted to give our good news, bad news, no news panelists a week off, a chance to be with their families, away from the stress of sorting out the news of the week. Sorry, America, you're going to have to judge news all on your own this week. But you know what? It's a holiday weekend, and we kind of want to talk to our friends, right? So let's visit Nancy French at home. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Nancy, what are you doing down there this weekend in Paris, Tennessee?
Well, I'm here with my family, and we are having a shooting contest off our back porch.
A shooting contest. Tell me how that works.
Well, we have an oak tree that has a target on it, and it's a paper plate target, and there's various levels, and I'm in the lead right now. I've gotten one of the innermost circles at 75 points.
Wait, so you're not, like, out in the yard or out in the woods. You're on your porch shooting guns.
No, but out in the woods and on our porch are not exclusive.
Okay.
We're both.
Okay. And you've got a ringer in the competition this year, right?
Yeah, the ringer is not doing as well as we had thought he might. My husband just came home from Iraq, and he is currently in second place with
wow.
a mere 50 points behind his wife.
Wow. Wow. Was that a gunshot I just heard?
That was him. He was trying to do it. He was trying to one-up me here, but I think he failed to do it from what I can see. It's about 50 feet. The target's about 50 feet away, so I can't exactly see it.
Now, Nancy, he was just in Iraq, and there was a war going on there, as you know and as he knows. Is he okay with this shooting guns at the house kind of thing right after he gets back from the war?
Oh, yeah. Well, lest people lose confidence in their American military, he is the Army's lawyer, so he's in the JAG Corps, so he's not actually out on the front lines.
Okay.
It's great. He said we're having a great time. We're not shooting, you know, at our house. We're just shooting from the house, and we got lots of open spaces around.
Okay. How far back does this tradition date?
I guess we started it when David went to Iraq last year. And
okay.
So last year I won the handgun competition, and my brother-in-law won the rifle competition. And so we have the kids. We're trying to teach them with parental guidance with their BB guns and maybe the occasional rifle shot. And so we're just trying to get everybody in the Thanksgiving spirit.
And what does the winner take home? Is there a trophy?
No, it's basically bragging rights, but
bragging rights.
In families, those go a long way.
Sure, sure. That can carry you all the way over to the next Thanksgiving.
Right.
Are you going to do this at Christmas as well?
We do it at Thanksgiving and Christmas. You know, because what says Christmas more than a back porch shootout?
Firearms. It's not often that I'm doing an interview and there's just gunshots going off in the background. At least not a pleasant, friendly interview from a nice home situation.
Well, it's a lot of fun. It's a great competition, and the kids love to see the adults getting into the, you know, they help make the paper plate, target. Sometimes we use tin cans and aluminum pie pans. So, you know, you got a lot of pie pans left over after Thanksgiving. So what?
Sure.
We're recyclers.
Okay, yeah, see? It's ecological. So how is this Thanksgiving different with David back from Iraq?
Oh, we're so thankful that he's back. Last year, it was very... I looked back at our video when we were doing the shootout last year, and it was just... There was a hollowness in the festivities last year, but we are very thankful to have him home. And cognizant of the sobriety of the times, that a lot of his friends are still over there, it's difficult and complicated, but we're very thankful to have him back, and this is really the best Thanksgiving we've ever had.
Well, Nancy, continued good luck, and I hope you take home or keep at home the bragging rights in this year's tournament.
I have a feeling I will.
Okay, good luck to you.
Thanks, John.
Nancy French is the author of A Red State of Mind. We have a few photos of Nancy and her dad and her son all shooting guns off the front porch. You can go look at that. WeekendAmerica.org. So Nancy's having a warm and pleasant time with her husband just home from a war zone. But there was nothing especially warm and cheery about the troop ships that took young soldiers to war in Vietnam in the late 1960s. Ships like the General Nelson M. Walker were damp, musty, and cram-packed with up to 5,000 men at once. Soldiers were pent up for 3 weeks on this 600-foot vessel during a voyage across the Pacific Ocean. But as producer Lydia Wilson tells us, many soldiers saw these troop ships as a last secure refuge before the uncertainties of war. It was where they lay their heads, and for a while, it was home, kind of. At night, some men used the bunk bed above them as a canvas.
I had wrote, you know, Rick and Pat and Manorville, Long Island, and the date, January 6, 1967, when I was going over on the Walker.
Rick Johnson is one of many young soldiers transported by the General Nelson M. Walker. Rick's personal space on the ship was only a bunk bed, but even that was stacked 4 high, so that lying down, his face was just inches from the bed above him. During long, slow, boring days, Rick and soldiers like him took out a pen and started doodling.
I guess it was just a loneliness. You know, yeah, everybody wants to leave the little piece of history, I guess. Maybe that's one way of doing it.
A black ballpoint pen drawing.
This history would have been lost if not for Art Beltrone.
And the wording, I wonder if they'll draft me. Another canvas, quote, born to raise hell in Vietnam.
Art spotted death these drawings 10 years ago when he was on board the Walker for a research project.
A large calendar from April 2nd.
The markings fascinated him. They ranged from skilled drawings to bathroom wall-like graffiti.
A naked woman.
There were sketches of curvy women and angry rants against the draft. But the Walker was scheduled to be destroyed for scrap metal. So Art went right back on with his wife Lee and an electrician's knife.
Lee is helping cut with a pair of snippers, and I'm using a knife to cut the heavy cord that attaches the canvas to the frame that a troop would lie on.
You know, I hadn't seen that, you know, in 30, 40 years or whatever. I felt, you know, kind of awe-inspiring a little bit because it was, I'm looking at these racks that were right in the ship where I had slept on.
Bill Painter was one of the Marines on the Walker. He recently drove an hour to see the canvases in a Virginia museum. The exhibit is a recreation of a bunk rack from the ship. Bill Painter remembers crowding on one just like it.
You spent most of your time, just three or four of you sitting in, you're talking to the people right across a little small aisle. You basically just sit there, and after a while, you all of you in that one area have talked out. You know, you're surrounded by people, and you do feel safe. You are like in a cocoon, but you know once you leave that ship, there is nothing but you.
This kind of anxiety was really common on the Walker. The soldiers were headed for an uncertain future in Vietnam. Wayne Cook recently recognized a friend's nickname on a canvas.
When I saw his name, Pigpen, kind of made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It was Larry Pigpen Jones. I was with him up till the time he got killed. I don't know if I can say this, but when you eat, sleep, and shower with a guy, you get to know him. It's a brother. You're closer to some of the Army guys than you ever will be to family members. We were very fortunate. We had a lot of great guys, and Larry was one of them.
A lot of guys like Pigpen never did come home from Vietnam. For survivors like Wayne Cook, it is very difficult to talk about losing their friends in battle. But listen to Wayne and other members of Pigpen's Vietnam unit at a recent veterans reunion. They've all seen the bunk bed canvases.
How did you guys deal with the boredom on board ship?
Everybody played cards. When you weren't swabbing the deck or doing KP, you played cards. It was a good trip for me. I had about $50 when I got on and $300 when I got off.
You know, that's interesting. All I played was 500 rummy. I have never played cards since.
I would like to say I believe that you guys remember what you want to remember.
Around this table, they share almost none of the horror stories from Nam that many of us probably associate with Vietnam vets. What's so unique about the graffitied canvases is that they remind veterans of a safer time. Time lying around, bored on the Walker. And as veteran Jerry Barker says, time spent with other young men in those last moments before serving their country at war.
Maybe that's what prompted a lot of us to ride on those canvases, on those bunks we slept in. Just leaving a little something behind in case we didn't make it. Because I know in the back of all of our minds, were we going to make it? Were we going to come home again?
That was the big thing. Am I going to get back?
Yeah.
I'm Lydia Wilson for Weekend America.
Have you heard of the ship called the Good Reuben James, armed by high-
fighting men, both of honor and of fame. She flew the stars and stripes of the land of the free, but tonight she's in her grave at the bottom of the sea.
The music you're hearing right now is actually played on the Walker to entertain troops on their way to Vietnam. It's The Good Ship Reuben James, written by Woody Guthrie in 1942. Art Beltrone's exhibit, Marking Time, Voyage to Vietnam, the collection of graffitied bunk bed canvases from the troop ship Walker, is traveling all over the country. This weekend, it comes home to Keswick, Virginia, from Volk Field in Wisconsin for a holiday break. You can see pictures of the Walker and read some of the graffiti at weekendamerica.org. If you had it in mind to go running this weekend and maybe burn a little of that holiday meal off, here's the scoop. You're going to get wet in the south, cold in the Midwest, hit by snow in the Northeast. Or, you know, you could just stay in and eat more. For tips on weather and fun, in case you do want to get out, here's Jeannie Yandel.
After the huge meal the nation just ate, it's only logical to ingest a bucket of cookies. Huh? Well, Wautoma, Wisconsin thinks so during their cookie walk and parade. 33 and sunny to collect and eat cookies and ignore your increasingly painful stomach. Then a Christmas parade, the highlight of which is a huge Pepto-Bismol fountain. In 1971, D.B. Cooper hijacked a jet and escaped by parachute with $200,000. He landed near Ariel, Washington, and disappeared forever. The people of Ariel celebrate the unsolved crime during the D.B. Cooper party. Foggy, Perfect, and 50 for a D.B. Cooper lookalike contest and stories about what might have happened to Cooper. Best story wins a very dusty $200,000 prize. Just kidding, FBI. Peanut butter and jelly, burgers and cheese, these food combinations are delicious. And Wilmington, Vermont says, why not fudge and sheep fur? They're pushing culinary limits at the sheep shearing weekend and fudge fondue kickoff. Have some cider, then shear some sheep after covering your fondue. 35 and cloudy, so maybe let the sheep keep their fur and just enjoy the fudge. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
New Hampshire is a small state, but I wouldn't want to try to run across it. This guy John LaCroix would, though. Find out why, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend after Thanksgiving, we've been exploring home, the idea of home, from a variety of angles. For many, home is a loving, happy place, but not for everyone. John LaCroix is a student at the University of New Hampshire and a long-distance runner, emphasis on the long. Today, for instance, John's out for a 60-mile jog around Lake Winnipesaukee. But that's nothing. Recently, John ran across the entire state of New Hampshire, 124 miles. Yeah, really. Reporter Sean Hurley met up with John and his running partner, Nate Sonnell, along the way to find out what drives someone to do that.
Stop on by, hang with the Hawk as we celebrate and cheer on Nate from National Power Sports and John as they run across New Hampshire for 124 miles.
I find them out on Route 9 as the sun dips behind the mountains. They've run 60 miles, almost halfway done. I park in the woods, hop over the highway barricade, and jog out to meet them. They've been running for 12 hours. We shuffle into position alongside the rumble strip. Nate's tall and lean, John shorter, with a strong wrestler's build. Cars zip past at 60, 70 miles per hour.
It was 29 degrees when we started this morning. And the wind was even colder then.
John LaCroix's only been running for 4 years. He didn't play sports in high school, and he never set out to do this.
Before running, I used hiking as my escape. And while I was hiking, I decided that I wanted to see how far I could go in a day.
How far did you go that day?
I hiked five mountains in the White Mountains. Before I knew it, I was doing 12, 13 mountains in a day. And I made a good friend named Tim Seaver. And Tim taught me about this ultra running thing. And I was hooked. I knew that this is what I wanted to do.
I've been running 10 minutes, and I'm already the most tired person in our group. When I ask John what compels him to run these vast distances, he doesn't tell me about running. He tells me about his childhood. His parents divorced when he was 12, and his family drifted apart.
For many years, I decided I was just going to deal with it. I was just going to take it and deal with it. And as the years went on, it kind of got worse. I ostracized some of my family members and went away to college, and I was pretty suicidal in college and ended up failing out.
It's nighttime, pitch black in some of these stretches, with wide dark fields to our left and no streetlights. But night is a prime running time for John.
Started in Conway at 7 o'clock at night. And it was one below at the top of Kangamangas Pass.
And what is that? Is that like 6 or 7 miles uphill for...
The Kangamangas Highway from Conway to Lincoln, it's actually 26 miles uphill.
Is this a good memory for you?
Oh, it's awesome. One of my favorite training runs to date. I mean, the moon lit everything up. There's so much snow. The whole world glowed that night. It was just us. Nobody else. It was amazing.
There's a crew car waiting on the sandy shoulder of the road ahead. On the roof, a gnarl of blinking Christmas lights. John and Nate depend on the crew and these makeshift aid stations. Nate crashes into a beach chair and tears off his shoes. John changes shirts and wolfs down a bag of potato chips. The crew refill their water bottles. One of the crew members, Sarah Cretion, is also John's fiance.
I think running has saved him. Absolutely. It's a great way for him to focus and center himself.
John rummages through the gear for a medical kit. For the last few miles, Nate's been struggling. He mentions blisters on his left foot, but he's been favoring the right. John kneels on the pavement and starts cutting tape with his teeth.
Now this isn't blister servicing, is it?
No, we're trying to pull my arch out. My arch is kind of collapsing. I got pain all in my arch and my heel. Is it not sticking?
John runs the tape under Nate's arch and draws a stirrup around his ankle. Nate picks out a new set of shoes. We set off again. Nate winces every time the right foot strikes pavement. It's difficult to see someone in this much pain labor on. Why not stop?
We always like to say, it's almost always going to get worse, and it's almost always going to get better.
They talk about pain a lot, about moving through pain, falling apart physically and mentally, and then coming out on the other side, somehow recovering. And I wonder if this is the engine that drives them both, finding your breaking point, breaking even.
I'm trying to just run through the pain, and right now it's not working that well. It's hard sometimes to remember that it's going to get better when it's really bad. And then when it starts to get better, it's such a pleasant surprise. It feels really good.
And a few minutes later, he's doubled over, limping off into a dark cornfield for the softness of the soil. He spins around, straightens, and comes back to try the road again. I'm close to the point of no return, so I stop. Wish them luck. Nate tells John to run ahead, He'll catch up, he says. John disappears quickly into the shadows. Later, I learn that Nate finally stopped at mile 70, 6 miles further on from where I left them. The following afternoon, I get a message. 31 hours and 50 minutes, it reads. I made it. And then there's a photograph of John, standing on a rock, white sea waves splashing all around, as though he'd rushed out into the ocean, unable to stop. Even though he'd done it, he'd crossed the state. His arms are raised as he stares over the water, the only substance that's ever been able to stop him from running. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Sean Hurley for Weekend America.
See pictures from John's run across New Hampshire. That's at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, who's eating leftovers this weekend. You know what? That can probably just go for all of the following names as well. They're either eating turkey or tofurkey. Sasha Oslanian, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Desiree Cooper, Sam Keenan, Michael May, Larissa Anderson, Hillary Frank, Michael Raphael, Chrissy Clark. Brendan Noonan says he's eating turkey leftovers in a hot tub this weekend, which, ew. Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, Ocean Kalen, Mark Sanchez, and Chris Wieg. The music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. That's a great way to keep up with the show, even if it's not the weekend. Here's some other ways. Become a fan of Weekend America on Facebook. We'll send you updates on stories we're working on, including ones where we could use your help. Or sign up for our feed on twitter.com as we put the show together over the course of the week. That's at twitter.com/theweekend. We'll keep you in on the loop. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for sweet reminiscences.
What I decided was that I would never have a favorite song and that instead I would hate all music forever.
You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. That's how much I did not enjoy that situation.
We're making new memories, so you can go ahead and forget those old ones. Join us for the next Weekend America.